listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Anita Pepper, Public Information Officer for the Nevada Department of Public Safety, which oversees the Zero Fatalities Program. And we're currently in what the organization calls the 100 Deadliest Days of Summer. Anita, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what is Zero Fatalities?
It is a program that has the end goal of getting the number of deaths on our road to zero. So we run an educational and a communication program throughout the state of Nevada, where we work on different initiatives to educate road users about safe road behaviors.
Okay. And what are the 100 deadliest days of summer?
So we are coming upon Memorial Day weekend, and as it turns out, May 27th marks the beginning of the 100 deadliest days, and it's typically the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day where traffic fatalities historically rise, especially among young drivers or new drivers, people that are licensed first-time drivers.
Why do roadway fatalities increase during the summer, especially among teens?
A lot of them are going to be on the road for the first time without parental supervision. With more freedom, they aren't in school, and they're going to be testing some of the limits, going, you know, on longer road trips, having friends in the car, those types of things.
What primarily causes roadway fatalities?
So a lot of the data shows us that speeding is one of the top causes, and also impairment. And impairment isn't always just alcohol. When we talk about impairment, we talk about drugs, we talk about prescription drugs. Sometimes people aren't aware that a prescription drug they might be taking can completely alter how they, you know, interact with the world. So we always remind people, if you're taking prescription drugs, make sure you look at the labels, understand if you should be operating a vehicle or not. The labels are usually pretty clear about that. And also just in general, if you're out enjoying high school graduation, college graduation, any sort of bon voyage party for people that are moving, anything that involves alcohol, Memorial weekend, lots of barbecues. If you feel different, you drive different. So this is the time to tell a friend, I need a ride home. This is a time to call an Uber, call a ride share, or just tell your friend, hey, I'm grabbing the couch. I'm not going to drive home tonight.
Yeah, okay. So speeding, impairment, what about distracted driving, like texting and driving?
Texting and driving is something that's very dangerous. We always encourage people just to try and map out everything before you get in the car. Put your phone in the glove compartment. Put it where it's not a distraction. It's such a habit for all of us to want to pick up our phone when we're driving, just take a quick look. And those quick seconds can absolutely be the end of your life. And it's just no text is that important. No email, no checking a Facebook post is that important. So you don't want to drive distracted. If you have a friend in the car, let them be the one who's dealing with the GPS. Let them be the one dealing with the stereo. And most smartphones nowadays have a do not disturb function. You should absolutely set that up on your phone. So people know that you're driving right now and that you'll call them back or you'll text them back when you get to a safe location.
Yeah, good tips. So we're less than halfway in, but how many roadway fatalities have we seen so far this year?
So unfortunately, 133 people have died on Nevada's roadways this year.
Is that normal for this time of year?
We're trending in line with where we were for the past few years. And the biggest, most unfortunate part of this overall trend is that we're trending upwards. So the numbers of deaths keep climbing. They're not going down. And we want to see that change.
Yeah, for sure. How do our roadway fatality numbers compare to other cities and other states?
As a whole, most of the numbers across the nation are trending upwards. So during the pandemic, drivers were off the road. And so a lot of people used this time to actually develop some reckless driving behaviors. We saw speeding go up. We saw impaired driving go up, those types of things. And unfortunately, the numbers just aren't going down.
Yeah. Now, of course, everyone says that they won't drive impaired and they won't text and drive, but they still do, whether it's peer pressure or whatever reason. So those of us who are parents of teens, what can we do to prevent that from happening?
One of the easiest ways is just to model good behavior. So when you're in the car with your kids, if you don't want your kids texting and driving, then you as a parent don't text and drive. If you are a parent who is celebrating, you should organize a ride share and don't be afraid to talk to your kids about that. Don't be afraid to tell your kids, hey, you guys, if you're going to be driving this weekend, give us a call. It's okay to call mom and dad if you feel like you're not in a condition to drive, if you feel like you've had too much to drink. So parents can talk to their children constantly about this is how we operate as a family. These are our family values. You know, our family values are we don't text and drive. Our family values are we don't drink and drive. So it's just a reminder that it's a conversation that can continually come up. Don't be afraid to have it. And like I said before, parents can model good driving behaviors so their children can adopt those habits as well.
Yeah, fantastic tips. So, where can people go for more information about safe driving and the Zero Fatalities program, including the 100 Deadliest Days of Summer?
Sure. So we have a website, which is zerofatalitiesnv.com. We also have an Instagram page, which is the same address, zerofatalitiesnv, and Facebook page as well. So we have lots of information in all three of those resources, and we have a lot of data. We also have an area where people can sign a pledge if they want to commit to being safe and sober drivers on Nevada's roadway.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, zerofatalitiesnv.com is the website for Zero Fatalities Nevada. You can also find them on Instagram with the same handle, Zero Fatalities NV. And there's lots of information that they give out on a regular basis to help us all keep safe on the roadways, especially now during the 100 Deadliest Days of Summer. This is the time to take action and make sure that everyone's safe on the roads. We've been speaking today with Anita Pepper, Public Information Officer for the Nevada Department of Public Safety, which oversees Zero Fatalities. And Anita, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about the dangers of driving impaired, speeding, driving distracted, and what we can do about it to keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heather.
There are a thousand ways to say it.
Nope. Knock it off. Shut it down. Dream on. No dice. Give it a rest. Not a chance.
Or just
all text. You focus on the road.
As a passenger, you have the power to prevent an accident. There are a thousand ways to stop a distracted driver. Choose one.
A message from CTIA.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Rupesh Parikh, practice president and a medical oncologist at Comprehensive Cancer Centers of Nevada. May is Skin Safety Awareness Month, and Comprehensive Cancer Centers of Nevada is marking its 12th year of offering free sunscreen and skin safety tips through nearly 20 major community partnerships. Dr. Parikh, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
So first of all, what is Comprehensive Cancer Centers of Nevada?
So Comprehensive Cancer Centers of Nevada is a freestanding multiple offices where we treat blood and cancer disorders. We have seven offices in the city of Las Vegas and its surrounding areas. We've been around for 40 plus years. We're the largest in Southern Nevada in terms of a big cancer center. So,
wow. Okay. What's your annual sunscreen and skin safety initiative all about?
So we want to do is we want to try and prevent cancer. That's the most important thing. That's not just skin cancer, but all cancers. But specifically for May, we focus on skin cancer. We want to make sure that everyone who hears this and everyone who comes to our offices prevents and does things for skin safety. Skin safety is super important because we all know that Las Vegas has a high UV index, meaning the sun is super strong and we can start getting burned within a myriad of 5 minutes to 10 minutes, depending on your skin type. So we want to do everything we can to help prevent, you know, sun damage, and sun damage has been linked to skin cancer. So that's where the initiative started years ago. And now we're in our 12th year of doing this for sunscreen initiative valley-wide.
Okay, so when you talk about skin safety, what exactly does that mean?
So skin safety is you have to use SPF 30, even if it's on a cloudy day, the UV rays still get in. We want to make sure that people cover up. Cats, certainly, protect your ears, neck, your entire face. Don't forget, you know, your feet also, your lips, for example, your hands. These are things that we don't usually think about when we are trying to avoid the sun. But all of these areas can have sun damage. And we want to make sure that all of these areas are covered with sunscreen, at least of SPF 30.
Okay. What are the latest facts on skin cancer?
So skin cancer, Probably there's 150 to 200 different types of skin cancer. Most of them can be prevented by applying sunscreen and taking protective measures. We all know that more aggressive skin cancers, like melanoma, for example, can be directly related to the sun damage, especially when people are growing up. There's probably about 100 to 110,000 new cases of melanoma in a year. In Las Vegas alone, we had about 1,050 cases diagnosed last year.
Wow, that seems pretty high.
It is. It's very high, actually. And it's one of the most preventable things we can do is skin safety, because it's so easy to just put sunscreen on and help protect our bodies.
Yeah. So beyond sunscreen, what are some of the latest advancements in skin cancer prevention and also treatment?
So treatment-wise, there's a lot of money that's been poured into it, a lot of research that's been poured into it. We all know that treatment can be variable depending on the type of cancer. Certainly, surgery remains standard of care. But if cancer has spread beyond that, we sometimes use radiation, we can use immunotherapy, sometimes even chemotherapy. But immunotherapy has really made a breakthrough in certain types of skin cancer, especially melanoma and how it's treated. We also have a lot of new research that we're doing, not only at comprehensive cancer centers, but, you know, with our partnerships across the network, in the U.S. Oncology Network, as well as UCLA, with clinical trials that we're doing, bringing new molecules to try and help treat cancer that's spread.
Okay. And for the skin safety program, who are some of your local community partners?
So we have a lot of partners with us. We certainly partner with the City of Las Vegas, City of North Las Vegas, Clark County Parks and Recreation, RTC Southern Nevada, the Aviators, the City of Henderson, UNLV, Las Vegas Lights, the Knights Foundation, the Penta Building Group, Cadence Master Plan Community. We are actually in downtown in the Container Park, at Red Rock, at Tivoli, at the District. You may have seen our little pop-ups with sunscreen in them that we want to try and spread to everyone. So,
awesome. Okay. So where can listeners go for more information on skin safety or get the free sunscreen and sun safety tips that you're giving out?
So certainly our website is available, cccnevada.com. There's links on the website that are certainly available. If you go to any of those locations that I mentioned, our sunscreens are available free of charge to anyone who wants them at all the Henderson parts, all the City of Las Vegas parts, etc. But certainly our website's a very useful tool, and we try and tell people to go to it for more information.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, that website is cccnevada.com. That stands for Comprehensive Cancer Centers of Nevada, cccnevada.com. You can find out all the latest tips on sun safety and skin cancer. And if you happen to see their free pop-up events around town, you can grab some free sunscreen, including at all of the venues that we talked about today. And we've been speaking with Dr. Rupesh Parikh, practice president and medical oncologist at Comprehensive Cancer Centers of Nevada. And Dr. Parikh, I really appreciate you being here, giving us the latest in skin safety and how to deal with the heat and the sun that we have here in Southern Nevada. And it's fantastic that you're offering free sunscreen and skin safety tips throughout the summer. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, and just remember to cover up. That's our motto for the month of May.
Most of us like to be out in the sun. That's why sunscreen and other safety measures are key to protecting your skin from aging and cancer. The FDA recommends using a sunscreen with a sun protection factor, or SPF, of 15 or higher. Also, look for broad spectrum on the label. That means both harmful ultraviolet A and B rays are blocked. UVA rays age the skin, UVB rays burn, and both cause cancer. But the perfect sunscreen doesn't count if you use it wrong. Don't need sunscreen on a cloudy day? Wrong. 80% of UV rays still get through the haze. Only use sunscreen at the beach? Nope. Anytime you're outside, UV rays attack the skin, so you need protection. And you have to reapply sunscreen every 2 hours. Remember, SPF plus broad spectrum equal healthy fun in the sun. Visit www.fda.gov/sunscreen for more information. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Larry Karsh, attending urologist and director of research at Advent Health Urology, and Mike, a patient who was diagnosed with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, or NMIBC, 7 years ago. May is Bladder Cancer Awareness Month, so it's important to know that bladder cancer is among the most common cancers in the U.S. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
So, Dr. Karsh, how common is bladder cancer?
Well, as you mentioned before, it's a very common cancer. About 83,000 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with bladder cancer each year. It's the sixth most common overall and the fourth most common in men, more commonly in men than women. And the hallmark symptom is blood in the urine, and it can manifest like cherry red color urine, rosé, burgundy, even cola color. And about 75%, at the time of diagnosis, 75% of these patients have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, or NMIBC. And it's a cancer that grows in the lining of the bladder. It has not yet progressed through the muscle or outside of the bladder.
Mike, what's your story with high-risk NMIBC?
Well, it was about 8 years ago, and I was using the restroom at my office, and I noticed blood in my urine. This was shocking. I had never seen that before. I called my wife, and she recommended I see the doctor as soon as possible. They were concerned that it may be cancer in my bladder and referred me to Urology Center in Colorado. They found a tumor, and I was diagnosed with NMIBC, the most common form of bladder cancer. Soon after BCG treatment, they found that tumors had recurred. Being diagnosed with NMIBC was nothing compared to the devastation I felt when the doctors told me that I was no longer responding to BCG. They presented me with the next best treatment, which was surgically removing my bladder. The thought of losing my bladder was terrifying, and I raised concern with the doctor. Fortunately, he offered me the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial using an experimental gene therapy treatment. All I had to do was visit the urologist's office once every 3 months for administration directly into my bladder. And because it's a gene therapy, I had no side effects, and I continued to work with no impact on my day-to-day life. I completed the process, and my urologist told me that the tumors were gone. This gave my wife and me an enduring sense of hope, knowing that we could continue doing the things we love. While the experience may not be the same for everyone, this was mine, and I am forever grateful. The gene therapy I was treated with is now approved by the FDA, and it's available to others. Finally, I'd like to echo Dr. Karsh's words that if you see any abnormal symptoms, seek medical care.
Yeah, for sure. So, Dr. Karsh, Mike talked about the experimental gene therapy that's now FDA approved. Before that, what has treatment for bladder cancer traditionally been?
So the traditional treatment or standard of care has been BCG treatment. And that is a liquefied form of an attenuated or weakened strain of a bacteria used for the tuberculosis vaccine. It's liquefied and placed into the bladder and given weekly for about 6 weeks and then about three treatments a week every 3 months thereafter. But not all patients respond to that. And if they don't, and we know that half the patients are going to have a recurrence within the first year. If they don't, then the next course of treatment would be to have your bladder removed through a cystectomy. And this newer treatment that we're talking about today is Adstiladrin. And I'm here on behalf of Ferring Pharmaceuticals. And it is a first and only FDA-approved gene therapy directed to the bladder. Some of the side effects can include urethral discharge, fatigue, some blood in the urine. But if you have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that's high risk and is not responding to BCG, then speak with your doctor to see whether or not you may be a candidate for this treatment therapy and visit adstiladrin.com to get more information about the therapy as well as some safety information. And it's got a convenient dosing schedule once every 3 months or quarterly. And it's given in the urologist's office where patients are familiar with the environment, they feel comfortable. So it's convenient dosing in a comfortable environment. And it is also a targeted gene therapy, not a chemotherapy, so that it works in the bladder to stimulate the immune cells in the bladder to fight the cancer.
So you did give the website, but I'm not sure if anyone caught it. So one more time, where can people go for more information?
So it's at stiladrin.com, A-D-S-T-I-L-A-D-R-I-N. And if you have a non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that has not responded to BCG, speak to your doctor and visit the stiladrin.com website for more prescribing and safety information.
All right, perfect. So once again, that website is stiladrin.com, A-D-S-T-I-L-A-D-R-I-N.com. You can find out more information. But of course, if you do have NMIBC, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, you will, of course, want to talk to your physician about that as well. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Larry Karsh, attending urologist and director of research at Advent Health Urology, and also Mike, a patient who was diagnosed with NMIBC. And this is a great time to talk about this. May is Bladder Cancer Awareness Month. As Dr. Karsh mentioned, it's the sixth most common cancer in the U.S., and it does affect men more than women. So if you or someone you know has it, this is a great option for treatment. Dr. Karsh and Mike, I want to thank you both so much for being here. Mike, for sharing your story, and Dr. Karsh for sharing more information about bladder cancer and new treatment options. So thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Hope it helps.
In honor of all those we've lost to cancer and those still fighting and thriving, like basketball analyst and cancer champion Dick Vitale.
I want to beat cancer. I'm going to beat it. That's no doubt in my mind. I'm going to win this battle.
Defeating cancer will take all of us. Join our team to help fund game-changing research that saves lives. At the V Foundation, V is for victory over cancer. V is for victory over the odds. V is for victory over health disparities. Victory over setbacks. Victory over the unknown. V is for victory over giving up.
Don't give up. Don't ever give up.
Join the V Foundation team and help save lives.
Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind, it cannot touch my heart, and it cannot touch my soul.
Join our team in the fight against cancer at V.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Jeff Kerr, Chief Legal Officer for the PETA Foundation. PETA has filed a first-of-its-kind First Amendment lawsuit against the National Institutes of Health and National Institute of Mental Health. Jeff, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks very much for having me, Heather. Pleasure to be here.
So, first of all, what exactly is the PETA Foundation?
The PETA Foundation is an affiliate of PETA. And our mission is to provide various supporting services to PETA, like the legal services that my department provides. We're our own separate animal protection charity, and that's what we do. We exist to support the operations of PETA.
Okay. Obviously, PETA standing for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So how did this groundbreaking lawsuit come about?
Well, we've been following the story of the macaques who are imprisoned and tortured in the NIH laboratory of Elizabeth Murray for 40 years, and to the tune of more than $50 million taxpayer dollars. She's been using crude and invasive methods to damage monkeys' brains. We've obtained footage and records of these horrible experiments in which she immobilizes each monkey's head in a vice-like device, carves out a section of the skull, and injects toxins into the brain to cause permanent and traumatic brain damage. And in some of the monkeys, she'll suction out or burn out portions of the brain. She then subjects them, she puts them in a cage with a guillotine-like door and subjects them to frightening stimuli like rubber snakes and spiders to see what their emotional reaction is. And of course, this is complete junk. It's never led to a single benefit for humans at all. And so one of the things we noticed as we were looking at the videos we've been able to obtain from public records requests is that these macaques are communicating in much the same way that humans do. Facial expressions, body posture, gestures, and also through physical manifestations over 70% of their hair falling out in some instances. And so the First Amendment protects the freedom of speech. Everybody knows that. But it also protects what's known as a right to listen. And because we were getting very limited amounts of these communications in the small videos that we could get, we believe, and this is what our lawsuit goes to, PETA has a First Amendment right to receive the communications from the macaques in this taxpayer-funded laboratory. And so what we're asking for is a live audiovisual feed to see and receive the macaque communications as to what they are telling us they're going through so that we can report on it to the world.
Okay, so since the First Amendment protects freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and also the right to listen, you're saying that the macaques are communicating with each other and you have the right to listen to what they're saying.
That's exactly right. And the ways in which they are communicating, like I mentioned, through body language, facial expressions, vocalizations, under the law, all of those utterances, all of those mannerisms constitute speech. We're not saying that the macaques have freedom of speech, a First Amendment right, but it's PETA's First Amendment right to receive those communications so that we can then report on their plight to the people in the United States and around the world.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, if this has been going on for so long, how many macaque monkeys are we talking about?
Well, hundreds over time. And it's unfortunate there are, you know, thousands and thousands of monkeys that are imprisoned and tortured in laboratories around the country. And of course, PETA's been at the forefront, one of the leading organizations, if not the leading organization, for decades trying to fight against these cruel and useless experiments. And finally, there is some good news, because following those years of PETA pressure, the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, is finally starting to shake off its old cruel habits and moving into humane and effective science. Just last week, the agency announced that it was launching a new initiative to reduce the use of animals in NIH-funded research and prioritize human-based research technologies. And this is a major paradigm shift that we've been calling for a long, long time. And in this regard, NIH's new plan is actually adopting several recommendations from PETA's Research Modernization Now strategy, which includes expanding funding, training, and infrastructure for non-animal methods, as well as shifting funds away from experiments on animals and towards superior non-animal methods. So we're hopeful, but there's still a long way to go.
So you've seen some videos from the lab. So beyond that, what is PETA seeking from this lawsuit in order to evaluate this macaque communication?
That's right. We want a 24/7 live audiovisual feed of the macaques so that we can see and process and interpret all of their communication. Our scientists in-house, and actually other scientists and scientific experts that we deal with, are able to interpret and understand what the macaques are saying to us, because macaque communication has been studied for decades and it's well understood. And already from just a few snippets of video that we've been able to get through public records requests, that these animals are telling us they want out, they're trying to escape, they're in distress, and even their own bodies are speaking to us. In some instances, you know, they've lost over 70% of their body hair. That's as a result of the stress and the torture that's being inflicted on them all the time. And we want the 24/7 video feed because we're only getting snippets from the very limited videos that the NIH experimenters are making themselves. And of course, that's highly controlled. We want to see what these macaques are telling us when they're confined in their solitary cage for the majority of the day. We want to see what they're telling us when people are coming to take them to experiments where they know bad things are going to happen to them. And we want to see what they're telling us after the experiments are over. And we have a right to receive that so we can tell the American people what's being done with their taxpayer dollars and in their name.
Yeah. All right. So where can people go if they'd like to get more information about PETA in general or this lawsuit specifically?
Go to PETA.org. You can see the lawsuit. You can see and read about PETA's Research Modernization Now strategy. And importantly, everyone can get involved in this by contacting their congresspeople, their senators, and encourage them to support this move away from animal-based testing and support research modernization now and end the funding of these cruel and useless animal experiments.
Okay, awesome. So once again, that website is PETA.org, PETA.org stands for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA.org. You can find out more about this lawsuit we've been talking about, and also contact Congress and let them know that you would like to move away from animal-based testing in this day and age. There isn't really a reason for it anymore. So let your Congress members know. And we've been speaking today with Jeff Kerr, Chief Legal Officer for the PETA Foundation. And Jeff, I really appreciate you being here and shedding light on this issue and what PETA is doing about it and what you hope the outcome to be. Really eye-opening to me and hopefully for a lot of listeners as well. So thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome, Heaven. Thanks very much for having me.
A dog? I'm not. I was born for a purpose. To bring you hope, to guide you out of darkness, to stand by you as you rediscover life. When past battles cloud your mind, I push them away. You tell me I'm your hero, just as you are mine. You hold me when you're afraid, whisper that I saved you. With me by your side, no challenge is too great, no night too dark. I'm your guide, your companion, your friend, your light. A dog? I'm not. With me, you see the world again.
Discover hope at Dogs, Inc. Visit us at dogsinc.org to learn more.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Brandy Britton, Executive Director and Career Expert at Robert Half. According to new Robert Half research, recent graduates and other early career professionals are facing career challenges, but have also identified some strategies to help them thrive. Brandy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what is Robert Half?
Robert Half is a specialized recruiting firm where we connect candidates with great career opportunities, providing high-touch services, a local market expertise, backed by our award-winning AI.
Okay, awesome. Now, according to your research, what are some of the biggest hurdles that today's college graduates face when they start entering the workforce?
Our Robert Half research tells us that more than 71% of professionals are having a difficult time getting an interview, even getting their resume seen. So to stand out in today's competitive market, we recommend individuals be adaptable to on-site work, consider contract work. You want to showcase those communication skills, both written as well as verbal, and be flexible in your starting salary. No matter how strong of a college mentor or advisor or friend of the family you have, these days it calls for more, and that's where we're here to help.
And what have the actual respondents, the early career professionals, identified as what they're doing to overcome these challenges?
Well, the challenges continue even after they get the job. From our survey of professionals, nearly half of the respondents said they lacked a mentor in their first job. It was difficult for them to manage heavy workloads, and they didn't feel confident about their skills or their experience. So at Robert Half, we recommend, no matter where you are in your career path, the GROW, G-R-O-W method, that's gaining experience through internships or contract roles, reaching out for a mentor. This could be a manager, a professor, or someone you trust. You want to own those soft skills and then work. Take every opportunity to work. Each opportunity provides you with skills and industry experience that can transfer onto future roles.
Yeah, that's really great advice. And I love the acronym. Now, what advice do you have for college graduates who aren't even certain what career path they should follow after they've gotten all this education under their belt?
It's definitely not uncommon for college graduates to be uncertain about their career path. So a great place to start is having conversations with career experts or recruiters. These individuals understand what's going on in the job market and what roles are in demand. From our experience with college students, roles in human resources, administrative support, and accounting and finance, where there's a well-documented shortage of skilled professionals, is a great place to look. We also recommend that individuals consider contract work. The benefit of contract work is it allows you to test the waters. You gain great experience, great skills, and all of these things make you more marketable in the moment as well as in the future.
Okay. Now, obviously, we all need some job-related hard skills before getting that job, but these are young people who haven't necessarily gotten those skills on the job. So what are some of the top skills that college students should hone before entering the workforce, whether that's hard skills or soft skills?
So soft skills are really what help you stand out. You want to focus on communication, adaptability, and time management. And if your skills aren't up to par and you're not getting traction, reach out to a professional recruiter. These individuals can help you refine your resume, role play interviews, and give you information on unposted jobs. All of this free to the job seeker and really helps you as a candidate gain confidence in your job search.
And then what if that new grad doesn't have any relevant experience for the jobs they're applying to and they've got maybe fantastic soft skills, but what would you recommend they do?
That's very common and it's not a deal breaker. In fact, more than one third told us they entered the workforce without an internship. In fact, I just spoke to somebody who we helped get an interview for. And in that interview, she was able to highlight her communication skills and time management that she got from campus projects, as well as leadership at school. And once she finished the interview, she was able to land the role in a contract position and ultimately went permanent in the position. So it's really all about identifying what are your transferable skills and finding a position that fulfills you and helps you grow.
Yeah, we all forget that some of the things you actually do during school, that project management and all of that, that is transferable to an outside job.
Absolutely. I think much of not what I studied, but the experience I had to go through in college with the university helped prepare me for the workforce.
Yeah, for sure. So where can early career professionals turn for help in their job search if they want that extra boost?
RobertHalf.com is a great place to look for job openings and to connect with a local career expert.
All right. Awesome. So RobertHalf.com is the website, RobertHalf.com. You can find out tips on those job searches. You can find salary guides there. You can reach out to a local recruiter who can help you along the journey and give you more one-on-one advice. RobertHalf.com. And we've been speaking today with Brandi Britton, Executive Director and Career Expert at Robert Half. And Brandi, I really appreciate you sharing the research and what the situation is for young professionals, as well as some amazing tips that they can use in their job search and go forward and have an amazing career. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Life is filled with many paths, but for Native American children, the most important path is the one that leads them out of poverty.
It's a path that led me here to St. Joseph's Indian School.
And 96% of St. Joe's students graduate high school. That's 10% higher than the national average.
St. Joseph's Indian School is our path to a brighter future.
Learn more at stjo.org today.
From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, welcome to I'm Listening. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and today we're joined by our colleagues from the AFSP for In This Together, Building Emotional Resilience in Ourselves and Our Communities. Odyssey's Katie Neal, host of the nationally syndicated Katie & Company, is joined by Chief Medical Officer for the AFSP, Dr. Christine Yu Moutier, and AFSP Oregon Chapter Board Chair, Vong Tran, for this meaningful conversation. Now, here's Katie Neal.
Welcome to an I'm Listening special. I'm Katie Neal, host of Odyssey's nationally syndicated country radio show, Katie & Company. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. Very excited about this conversation.
Yeah, so thanks. Am I. So May is Mental Health Awareness Month, destigmatizing conversations around mental health, because we know that openly talking about mental health and suicide in a very healthy way can help reduce negative stigma as well as save lives. We're also going to talk about how to think about your own mental health and everyday approaches that you can take to aid your overall well-being. Dr. Moutier, I would love if you could talk about the AFSP's new campaign, which focuses on resiliency. And I would love if you could just talk about what that means in the context of mental health, the word resiliency.
Yeah, so resilience is this concept that's about really a deeply innate ability that we all have. We're probably practicing it all the time without even realizing it. But like other strengths or muscles that we can build with some intentionality, we can actually go even further with it. And so what we mean by resilience is it's that ability to cope and respond to challenges, the demands of life. And of course, life is so very unpredictable for all of us. That is just, life throws us curveballs. That's a fact. Maybe we don't grow up kind of thinking that or understanding that. But at some point, I think it helps to actually accept the fact that one thing is certain, and that there will be unpredictabilities and unexpected curveballs and turns of life. And so the way that we respond to all that is really about exercising that muscle of resilience. And it's about maintaining a sense of stability, a sense of self, a sense of connection to others and community, even through the hard times. And so, you know, mental health is really dynamic. It's like other aspects of health. Our physical health can change. It goes through ups and downs. Some of us have physical health conditions. Some of us have mental health conditions, and many people have both. And it's about managing and optimizing all of that. And resilience is kind of in a way, it's a tactic or a strategy to ground ourselves, to stay stable. And I think, you know, we'll be able to think through what that could look like, you know, in our lives as we learn how to kind of practice that muscle of resilience.
I love the comparisons that you give to your physical body through resilience along with your mental health, because in 2025, I feel like there's so much focus on physical health and people are much more in tune with what we're putting into our bodies, how we exercise, how we care for our bodies, the medications that we take so that it performs the best that it can. And I think the same can be said about our mental health. So I would love next if you could talk about the exercising people can do to strengthen their own mental health, their resiliency, to help build resiliency, and the tools that are available to them. Dr. Moutier, could you give some examples of that?
Yeah, sure. And the first thing I would start with is to remember that your mental health is very multifaceted, but there is an organ in your body where much of our mental health is stemming from ultimately, and that is the brain, and the brain is connected to the rest of the body. So anything you do for your physical health, you'll not only gain the benefit in your heart and in your muscles and in your lungs, but also in your brain. So that means physical exercise. That means better sleep hygiene. It can look like being very mindful about how to optimize your diet, your nutrition, other substance use, and staying hydrated, all of those things. But then it goes the other way around as well, so that the things that we think about for our mental health, whether it's, you know, how to learn, and I use that word very intentionally, because we oftentimes go through, again, the challenges of life or good times, and we're not necessarily being mindful about what are the inputs that produce different outcomes for our mental health. And the more we can learn about the influences that are positive and the influences that are negative. The more we can make very intentional choices about shaping our stability and, again, growing that muscle of resilience. So, you know, you can think about, like, the old term for it was stress management. And in fact, people, you know, here's some old, you know, kind of medical history, that people who went through things like a heart attack were advised about not only diet and not smoking and exercise, but were also advised about stress management. Because the more that we're able to learn how to adapt and, again, how to cope with stressors that are there, that will affect not only our brain and the state of our mental health, but it actually also affects the state of your heart if you're somebody who has a history of heart disease. So there's a very deep connection between brain and body and the choices that we make and how we can learn. And really, like, for myself and for my loved ones and the community, it's not about striving for perfection. It's really never about that, because that's an illusion. It's about making small steps of progress. And that's the way that we can not only learn and really develop over time. This can take time. It's not necessarily an overnight thing to expect of ourselves, but also a way to cultivate a sense of self-compassion, that it is okay that we have ups and downs, that we make mistakes. That's a part of life. It's a part of being human. And learning to kind of accept that and cultivating that, you know, oftentimes we would have that view for others, being very forgiving and compassionate, but we don't have that towards ourselves in our own internal dialogue. So a lot of that can be part of this, you know, experience of developing resilience.
Absolutely. I want to circle back to two different things that you said. One of them was just thinking about how, you know, a part of life that can be very healthy is accepting that there are going to be ups and downs. You actually can't change that. That's out of your control. But changing how you react to that. I know that in my own mental health journey, that was something that it took me a moment to to really sink in, because I thought, oh, well, if this is the input, this is always going to be my output. But actually, you can change that. And just being aware of your emotions and how you react to things is so powerful.
That is 1,000% true. And I'm kind of getting chills as you're saying it, because when you're able to experience that shift in, it's not necessarily that you feel that you're a victim in life, but you just feel this sense of passive, you know, life is happening to you. But there can be this fundamental shift where you realize there are actually things that you can do, because the way that I view it conceptually is that the brain, the mind, is the mediator between the things that are happening in our lives, how we process them, and the output that happens. We have more control over than we realize if we learn how to optimize that sort of control center, if you will, of the mind, and developing, you know, an awareness of our thoughts, a mindfulness about our sense of presence and the way we show up for ourselves and with others.
The second thing that I wanted to touch on that you said is that this does take time. And I very much like physical exercise, and I'll embarrass myself here by saying this, but I think of it in terms of like stretching. Like, I'm very inflexible. I can't touch my toes. But if I want to be able to, I know I'm going to have to stretch every day for months just to get a little bit closer. And I do think the same can be said about your own mental health. From my experience, like, I remember I started, you know, going to therapy, taking an SSRI, and it was, you know, a week later, and I was like, well, I can't believe that I can't do this yet. And it's not working. And it's like, well, sometimes it takes 6 months to a year before you really start to notice those changes. So I think giving yourself the compassion that this is a journey, not an overnight deal, that also is very important to remember.
Yeah. And we wouldn't expect it of our heart to recover that quickly, or to grow the muscles, you know, for running, and the same thing goes for the brain. Definitely takes time.
Fong, I would love if you could talk about some ways that you utilize mental health exercises in your everyday life to build resiliency.
Yeah, I loved all of that. The self-compassion, the time that it takes to, before I answer your question, yeah, it does take a lot of time. I've been on this journey for over 7-8 years. And there are still times where I take 2 steps back a little bit and then 1 step forward. And so, although it takes a lot of time, it's also not linear at the same time. It can move in so many different directions. So thanks for mentioning that. I really like that a lot. In terms of Yeah, things that I do to kind of exercise that mental health resiliency. So for example, with my morning routine, something that I do to kind of like, to kind of start to the day is having some quiet time in the morning before I even start my day. Instead of scrolling and going on social media or checking my email first thing in the morning, which I used to do all the time, it's starting out my day in a very calm and relaxed state before I hop onto the highway, right? That's one example. Another thing that I do too is you guys talked about self-compassion, which is something that you have to exercise. It's not something that you just learn just by living, right? And that's something that I've been exercising for the last 7 years, is taking some time, intentional silence and solitude, to have some self-compassion on the different parts of myself. For me and a lot of men out there as well, we struggle with shame. And so having that self-compassion on that shame, I kind of think of shame as kind of like that classic football coach that kind of yells at you kind of thing, right? Telling you to like, hey, get better, do those 20 push-ups, get it done now, or you're a loser kind of thing. But what I found is that shame is just trying to get you to be a little bit better and to improve yourself, not in the best way. But you can have some self-compassion on that too.
If you're listening and some of these things have really clicked for you, if you're listening and some things feel a little far away, hard to grasp right now, your mental health journey starts the second that you decide that it does. And Christine, I would love if you could talk about places that people can find resources no matter where they are in their journey right now after they listen to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to also just bring into the conversation that we all grow up in homes and in cultures that may be different. You know, for Vong and I, we probably share some Asian heritage, and there are some belief systems that are common when you grow up where, you know, feelings aren't really necessarily something that exists always in that world. But whether it's, you know, a Black family, Hispanic, you know, really the truth is every culture and every people group has its own version of ways that mental health had attachments that weren't correct. They were associated with weakness and shame, and that we know that's not true from science. We all have brains, we all have mental health, and we all go through things and have our internal life. And so I love the way that you all just spoke about how you and Vong kind of took that into your own, you know, your own agency to make some choices and take learn more about your mental health and really be proactive. It's just really incredible, both of your journeys and how you've shared it. And yeah, if anyone is interested in taking that next step for yourselves, there's so many different ways that you can learn more about this topic. Certainly on our website, afsp.org. We would love for you to visit and just check out some of our resources. There's a chapter near you. There are other wonderful organizations like NAMI that offer education and support and even helplines. There's 988 that's available 24/7 to anyone who's going through any type of mental health experience or crisis. Doesn't have to be a suicidal crisis, but it certainly can be. You can also be the helping person. You don't have to be the one going through it yourself, but you're worried about someone and you're not sure what next step to take. 988 is there for you as well.
That's so wonderful. Thank you both for your time today and for sharing your stories. We so appreciate it. And thank you for tuning in to this I'm Listening special.
Our thanks to Dr. Christine Yu Moutier and Vong Tran from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for their time and dedication to better mental health. For more resources, please visit afsp.org. And if you or someone you know is in crisis and needs someone to talk with immediately, please call or text 988. For the full show and more stories like this, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org.
Did you know that those with mental health challenges can be right in front of our eyes, but still go unseen? Behind some smiles, there's hidden pain because our struggles aren't always on the surface. And they can affect anyone, anywhere, at any time. Our Black youth are at a higher risk for depression, anxiety, and other mental health struggles. Only 1 in 4 seeks treatment, and the stigma lingers. It's okay not to feel okay. There's strength in connecting and seeking help. Break the barriers. Break the silence. Sharing is healing. Share. Connect. Get informed. Your mental health is in your hands. Visit melaninthriving.com/mental health in your hands.
This message brought to you by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the valley. Three Square's Bag Childhood Hunger Campaign is doubling its impact thanks to matching sponsors through next Saturday, May 31st. For every dollar donated, Three Square can now provide up to 6 wholesome, nutritious meals to Southern Nevada children and families in need. Find out more or make a donation at threesquare.org. That's threesquare.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, June 9th at 8 p.m. benefiting Down Syndrome Connections, and Monday, June 23rd at 8 p.m. benefiting the 3630 Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And the Las Vegas Rescue Mission is holding their annual bottled water drive through August 31st. When the summer is hot, vulnerable community members experiencing homelessness need water more than ever. You can drop off bottled water donations at the Las Vegas Rescue Mission security gate 24/7. Find out more at vegasrescue.org. That's vegasrescue.org.